Good morning, planet Earth. Good morning to my various listeners out there in regions 12 and 46. Good morning to Zone 902 and to the people in rebellion against the evil Lord Gomdor. Good morning to the people of New York City and Dallas, Texas. Good morning to the Hill People and the Hill Tribes and the various tribes of Kansas and Arkansas. Good morning to the Eagle and the Raccoon. Good morning to the Killer Whale and the Salmon. Good morning to the Frog and the Gator. Time's coming for you. Good morning to the Sun. As it burns so hot in the sky, good morning to the rain, wherever you're falling, baby. It is Monday, June the 20th, 2022 in the time of Boblimptalk. It is still technically morning because it's almost 11 a.m. here in Utah, Mountain Standard Time. And there's a grim subject that I have not wanted to discuss because it could happen. If it does happen, I really don't know if we can assume it was an accident. Before I get into the core topics of today, I want to say happy federal holiday for Juneteenth, the day that some general in Texas said all the slaves were free, except for they went from one form of slavery to another, just like the rest of us. I saw this documentary once about Scientology, and they were so excited that they escaped Scientology. And then there was an episode of this documentary series where they brought in an FBI agent, or no, actually a police officer. And I thought to myself at that moment, dear sir, dear ma'am, you escaped one Scientology to find yourself in a greater Scientology. Because that's the truth. The truth is that whatever the Civil War was about, the net effect wasn't really the freedom of anybody. I mean, I know that that's what we're told. We're told that African American people were made free, but I think many of them would say for the next century they still dealt with the structural equivalents of racism. They still dealt with a system that wanted to sideline them, and they still dealt with the historical condition that had never been fixed. I mean, you know, we talk a lot about making up for losses, you know, reparations. And there have been attempts at reparations for the people who suffered under the Holocaust, for Japanese who were imprisoned during World War II. But if we're being honest, that never really happened with the slaves. And if you want to make the argument, well, you know, I didn't own slaves. I didn't own slaves either. In fact, a lot of my people were basically forced into enlistment after they got off the fucking boats in New York City. So my people more or less were turned into war grease, hamburger meat, the very second they set foot in the United States of America. For the most part, a lot of them did. They came from a crappy situation in Ireland to an even crappier situation here because nobody wanted them here. Did you know that? Did you know that there's been prejudice against many peoples and there have been many standards applied that have been unfair? And did you know that your government has violated many contracts throughout history, many treaties, many agreements? You don't need to trust me. Do your own fucking research. So we can be honest that there was no reparation. The 40 acres and a mule, I don't know that that was ever really done, but the truth is, there was no reparation for what happened. For the profound destruction of Native culture over the last few hundred years, there was no reparation. I mean, yeah, pushing people into tiny little postage stamp-sized versions of where they once roamed, you may see the reservation as a reparation. No, the reservation was the last holdout. The last place, the last holdout, the last chance saloon. The reservation kept Native culture alive, but the reservation was not reparations. They are not the same thing, okay? It'd be like at the end of World War II, or better yet, during World War II, Hitler changes his mind, but decides to keep all the Jewish people in the camps. They're no longer death camps, and they get to open up a casino. That would be the equivalent of what happened to Native Americans. Now, of course, they could leave and they can leave and they can leave their culture behind. But for the most part, there was never any reparation. There was never any attempt to fix that. And it's not just special to the United States. This type of pattern exists for government throughout history. Governments have trampled people's rights invariably throughout history. They are a form of leverage of the worst parts of the human spirit. And the worst manifestation of the leverage of government is war. You can say what you will about the war between the states. I fear that at some point in the future, you will learn the difference between a war between nations and an actual civil war. The war in Yugoslavia back in the 90s, that's an actual civil war, okay? That's how crazy that stuff gets. The instability in Lebanon since the 70s, that's what civil war looks like, okay? But when you have separate armies with separate uniforms and separate governments, that's not really a civil war. That's a war between two nations. You may not like the fact that the Confederacy came into existence, but it was, for a brief time, a separate nation, whether you like it or not. Calling it civil war is an insult to the concept. The concept comes from ancient Rome for the most part. And believe me, civil wars back then were very much brother against brother, sister against sister in the same fucking city. Just like Yugoslavia. Just like Lebanon, and not so much like what we call our civil war. So I just want to get that out of the way. I don't care who won that war because I don't think anybody wins any fucking war. If the argument goes that, well, we would never fear, freed the slaves if not for that war, there were points in that war where the government of the United States was willing to guarantee slavery for 100 years in the states that currently had it. There was a point in that war where Lincoln would have been willing to do that to end it. So before you get all high and mighty about the Civil War being about making sure black people are free, understand this. The emancipation of African American slaves in North America was a byproduct of a war. It wasn't the goal. The goal was power, as it always is. And the end result after the war was ended was power. And you could even argue that that obsession, that nasty, greasy obsession with power, is why African Americans remained the football for another 100 years plus. But that's just my Irish fucking opinion, right? So happy Juneteenth, belatedly, today's the federal version, right? Yesterday was the official day, but today's the day you get off. Isn't it funny? The banks have already figured out how to take advantage of that shit, baby. They shut it down, baby. They shut down transactions in honor of African Americans. Yeah, I could see how Juneteenth is helping banks right now. Any day they get where they can take a pause, between bad repo situations, bad contracts, bad accounts, bad credit. Any moment these banks can take a breather, they are thankful for. So I'll tell you who's most thankful for Juneteenth. The major banks of the United States of America. Happy Juneteenth. Because believe me, right now they can take any bank holiday they get. Anyone. So happy Juneteenth. I'm going to read an article from Zero Hedge. It is penned by, written by the nom de plume Tyler Durden, and it was published today. I think it was more like it was updated today because it was on their post yesterday at 9 a.m. And this is an update as of 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Russian Foreign Ministry has responded to Lithuania's partial blockade of Kaliningrad, writing in a statement that they consider the provocative measures to be openly hostile and warning that the Kremlin may take action to protect its national interests. Kaliningrad is sandwiched between the EU and NATO members Poland and Lithuania. Supplies from Russia are delivered via rail and gas pipelines through Lithuania, which announced last week that it was banning the rail transit of goods subject to EU sanctions, which include coal, advanced technology, metals, and construction materials. And I quote, "If in the near future the cargo transit between Kaliningrad region and the rest of the territory of the Russian Federation through Lithuania is not restored in full, then Russia reserves the right to take actions to protect its national interests," the statement reads. They have demanded that Lithuania immediately lift the ban on a number of goods to the Kaliningrad region. A strong protest was made to the head of the diplomatic mission in connection with the ban imposed by Vilnius on the rail transit of a large range of goods through the territory of Lithuania to Kaliningrad region without prior notice to the Russian side. "We demanded the immediate cancellation of these restrictions. We pointed out that we consider provocative measures of Lithuanian side that violate Lithuania's international legal obligations, first of all, the joint statement of the Russian Federation and the European Union on transit between Kaliningrad region and the rest of the Russian Federation of 2002, to be openly hostile. We have stated in this connection that if cargo transit between the Kaliningrad region and the rest of the territory of the Russian Federation through Lithuania is not restored in full in the near future, Russia reserves the right to act to protect its national interests." Earlier Monday, the Kremlin called Lithuania's announcement unprecedented and in violation of everything there is. "The situation is more than serious and it requires a very deep analysis before formulating any measures and decisions," said Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov in a statement to the press. Lithuanian Foreign Minister Gabrielius Landsbergis said they were simply complying with sanctions imposed by the EU and that they were taken after consultation with the European Commission and under its guidelines. "Sanctioned goods will no longer be allowed to transit Lithuanian territory," he added. Kaliningrad Governor Antav Alekhinov says the ban, which was confirmed on Friday, affects roughly 50% of all imports. He urged citizens not to panic buy, but to no avail. "Quite possibly the biggest Russia-West provocation of the entire four-month-long war in the Ukraine has occurred this weekend, but few in the media establishment seem to be taking notice of the singular event which has the potential to quickly spiral towards a World War III scenario. Baltic EU-NATO member Lithuania has implemented a ban on all rail transit goods going to Russia's far western exclave of Kaliningrad after transport authorities initially announced the provocative measures on Friday. And I quote, "The EU sanctions list notably includes coal, metals, construction materials, and advanced technology." And Alekhinov said the ban would cover around 50%. Okay, already see above. It's kind of repeating itself, this article. I'm going to let you guys read the rest of this on your own. Let's talk about Kaliningrad. Kaliningrad, and again, if I'm not pronouncing it right, fuck you. Kaliningrad was once known as East Prussia. Okay? A long time ago, there was a place called Prussia when Germany was not unified. Many people don't understand this, but prior to the late 19th century, Germany was not one country. It was several countries. And under Otto von Bismarck, under the leadership of that crazy dude, Prussia unified Germany by invading other German states and taking control. Understand this. If you went to a German today and explained to them that that maneuver on the part of Bismarck happened further in the future, which means it happened more current than anything involving Crimea or the Ukraine, and you said that based upon that historical point, that all those parts of Germany should be liberated, they would say, you're evil, you're a scumbag, go fuck yourself. But the reality is, Bismarck unified Germany way after the Russians took Crimea, way after Ukraine was partitioned between Poland and Russia, way after any of those things happened. So in terms of a historical connection, given that we're celebrating Juneteenth, the invasions of those various German territories occurred in some cases after the end of the American Civil War. Happy Juneteenth. So the arguments being made against Russia currently, even if you believe those are valid, are also quite invalid given that, yeah, Germany more or less would not exist if it hadn't have done exactly what Putin is currently doing. I'm not saying what Putin did is right or wrong. I have read that there have been human rights atrocities in the culturally Russian regions of eastern Ukraine since 2014. And back in 2014, I was incensed by, it disgusted me what the Obama administration and the CIA did in the Ukraine by toppling that government. At the time, I thought it was really dangerous. So dangerous that people should say something. Most of the people I knew didn't give a fuck. They did not give a fuck that the United States went into the Ukraine and toppled the government. They couldn't care less. These are the same motherfuckers who are telling you we should go give MLRS and other weapons to the Ukrainian Nazis and whatnot. I gotta say, I'm having a hard time keeping up with all their fucking contradictions. Really. Especially the liberal fucks. The so-called Democrats. Those pieces of shit. I mean, the Republicans are bad. They're all bad. But I don't know how any of the fucking Democrats keep the shit straight in their head. Hate Nazis here, love Nazis there. That is basically the philosophy right now of the Biden administration. We really love those Nazis in the Ukraine, but we're fighting the Nazis at home. I personally think all Nazis suck, and all commies suck, and all socialists suck, which pretty much means the entire United States government sucks. That's where I'm at. So you can pick and choose what flavor of socialism is your favorite form of buggery, but it all pretty much sucks at this point. Now, before I continue, because I really didn't want to talk about the Ukraine situation, but I felt a little compelled to do so today. Before I continue, I want to point out some assumptions I'm making before I get too deep. Number one is I don't believe you can expect any participant in the international system right now to respect treaties. The main reason is the United States doesn't. And there's this idea called lead by example, and the United States has more than shown in recent memory, if not its entire history, that it couldn't give a fuck about a treaty or an agreement. The Bush administration, back in, I believe, 90 or 91, promised the Soviet Union and Gorbachev that NATO expansion would not move past Poland. Since then, that agreement's been broken multiple fucking times, to include the attempt to put Ukraine into NATO, which is batshit crazy. On so many levels, just fucking insane. So I don't expect anyone in the current system to obey any treaties, any international law at all. The United States doesn't. China doesn't. And if Russia does, they do it to their detriment because, you know, no one else is going to. So one of my assumptions at this point is, if you think the treaty's going to help you, fuck yourself. Just because we have a treaty or an agreement to defend Taiwan does not imply we will. It also does not imply we won't. It just means that that piece of paper is worthless. It is totally fucking worthless. The only paper that the United States has had, probably in the last 40 years, that people more or less think is useful and I guess has a truthiness to it, is the US dollar. And the US dollar is in the process of collapsing. The reserve currency is going away. That's one of the reasons why these wars are kicking up, because this empire is falling apart. So if you expect a treaty to work, it's not going to. And if you believe that US dollars are going to grease the pump, I don't think it works that way any longer. I think people are beginning to wise up and realize that that money is just crap. It's useless to them. It holds them back. So don't expect treaties to work. Another assumption. I think most of the major powers right now, the United States, the European powers, and I would even include Putin, although his situation may not be nearly as bad, but pretty much every major government on the planet right now is in a precarious situation. The monkey herpes, whatever you think about the COVID, I don't give a fuck, did not help the credibility of institutions. Me personally, I think it was 99.9% psyop. If you think it was a little bit real, you can take 0.001% and put that in your court and go play fucking basketball and pretend you're an NBA player. But me, I think it was mostly bullshit. And I don't think I'm alone. Despite all the propaganda, all the bullshit polls, I think a lot of Americans did not get the vaccine. I think a huge number did not. And I think a huge number recognized the COVID as some kind of fucking bullshit. And when you're doing that kind of bullshit to your own people, whatever social contract or credibility you think you have left is gone. It's one of the reasons why I've gotten dark in the last couple of years with respect to the situation, because they have done everything they can to burn bridges. They have done everything they can to essentially give up legitimate authority. It's almost as if they're begging the American people to storm Washington, D.C. and set it on fire. And I don't mean January 6th, buddy. That's called Operation Chaos. That's FBI going back to the 1960s. That's bullshit. I mean the real thing that's not going to be fucking televised. So another assumption I'm making is that just about every government right now, every major power could use a distraction. And war, it's horrific and terrible and disgusting, but it does operate as a kind of fucking distraction. I also am assuming that the United States government is not being honest about readiness, about the state of the military. I have my own experiences going back to the 90s, which again, you know, it's 20 plus years ago, but I think that the US government is lying about the state of the military. I don't think we're ready for any kind of major conflict. I have no doubt that we can still beat up on poor countries and people that, you know, have brown skin, so to speak. We can still do that. We can still pummel a third world country to steal its oil. But I don't think we have the resources to go toe to toe with a major power. Especially considering that the calculus of nuclear war basically says if you're going to do this, you better win fast. You better topple that enemy government, and there better be somebody there who's willing to sign a treaty, because if they're not, it all ends in a nuclear war of one form or another. I'm also assuming that those nuclear powers that have nukes will use them, okay? I know that sounds like a radical assumption, but there's a reason why countries like Israel, like Iran, like Pakistan, like India, like China, like France and Great Britain, and frankly, I bet there's a bunch of others who have secret nukes. There's a reason why countries have acquired nuclear weapons. And you can debate, you know, mutually assured destruction and all kinds of other Rand Corporation Doritos for the brain, but here's what I will say. If a country has nukes, you should assume that they fit within some part of their strategic decision-making process. It doesn't mean they'll immediately use them first thing. It just means that at some point in the process, they will. And the last assumption I'm making for this context is that no matter what you think about Vladimir Putin, I don't give a fuck. I have given up on trying to explain to Americans that in the history of Russian leaders, he is far from the worst, and the people who sit behind him who will take over if he gets killed are way fucking worse. Okay? They are not remotely trying to make peace. They're kind of wanting to angle to kill Putin at some point because, hey, why aren't you taking action? There's a good chance that one of the reasons why Putin acted with respect to the Ukraine is that his own government was basically saying, you do something or you're going. You're gone. You do something and there are others who will replace you. So I don't think Putin's a nice guy, but I am assuming on some level that the Russian government and Putin, that these are rational actors, that they just don't want to start World War III. They don't want to nuke the whole world. I'm sure the Russians would be okay if United States' folly led to a huge economic backlash. Because why? Because the United States had an opportunity in the 90s to help Russia, to do with Russia with what we did essentially with Japan and Germany after World War II. We had an opportunity to do the right thing and we fucked it up. And more than one Russian historian will tell you this. There was a chance in the 90s to avoid all of this. And instead of avoiding it, we took advantage. We took advantage. We took it. We used every opportunity to put our own greasy oligarchs into their system. And that had a backlash. And it started with the defeat of Yeltsin, but it ended up at Putin. Putin is what you were going to get, given what we did. So Putin might not be a nice guy. Elder Bush, who ran this country 1989 to 1993, how can I explain this? He was director CIA. I can guarantee you that guy was a piece of shit. So please stop with this Putin's not a nice guy crap. None of these motherfuckers who make it to that level are nice people. They're not nice women. They're not nice guys. Most of them are sociopaths. It doesn't mean they're crazy. One hopes they're rational sociopaths on some level, but none of them are nice people. So give up on that bullshit. Now, here are the outstanding nuclear scenarios that exist, okay? And I am deliberately not talking about NATO in this case for reasons I'll get into. There's obviously the conflict between the United States and Russia that could erupt, a nuclear conflict. You could say NATO versus Russia if you want to. We'll get to that in a moment. There's obviously the possibility that the United States could get into a nuclear conflict with China. And I believe there are scenarios where weak alliances and strong alliances could form between Russia and China, especially if a conflict heats up. Israel versus Iran is a real conflict. I would argue Israel versus many countries is a real potential nuclear conflict. You know, they've had strategic policies, quote unquote, that have been secret, quote unquote, that involve the massive swarm nuclear counterattack of many countries and capitals, to include Berlin. I mean, the Israelis, whatever you think about the state of Israel, and I don't really care. They have nuclear weapons, and I have no doubt that they would use them. Iran might have nuclear weapons. They would claim right now they don't. I have no idea. North Korea has nuclear weapons, but I think North Korea is more or less going to go the way of China, with respect to their actions. So I don't know what they would do with their nukes other than use them against the United States. And I think they would be more likely to act if there was already a war ongoing between China and the US. And of course, there's Pakistan versus India. And there could be several others that we don't know about. I mean, I'm of the opinion that probably almost every government on the planet right now has one or two secret nukes. You don't have to have reactors to have nukes. You just have to have somebody with reactors who's willing to sell you the material. willing to sell you the uranium, willing to sell you the plutonium, willing to sell you the tritium. If they're willing to give it to you, you can build a nuke. And I bet there's more than a few countries out there that have one or two secret nukes. Why? Why the fuck not? I mean, I know there are people who want to talk about treaties and obligations, but the history of the world in the last two decades should tell you that none of these actors respect them. That's why I started out with that assumption. Throw out your treaties, throw out your fucking agreements. None of them will be meaningful when the metal starts grinding flesh. And that's right now. So when I was in graduate school 20-some years ago, I had this theory. And maybe I should have explored it. Maybe I should have made it my thesis topic. I'm a person filled with regrets. But I called it Firestorm. And at the time, I was training to be a U.S. Army officer. I was in graduate school studying Russian history, but I was studying military history and military science as well. And a lot of the doctrine of the United States military going back to the 90s, that post-Cold War doctrine, was this idea that we need to be prepared to fight roughly two and a half regional wars at the same time. Which means, imagine an Iraq scenario like in the early 90s, or the Iraq scenario after, Iraq flew planes. They didn't fly planes. For whatever gruesome reasons, we decided to attack Iraq in 2003, blimp talk. Whatever gruesome bullshit you want to believe, the belief in the 90s was we could do 2.5 of those. 2.5. I don't really know that that's even true. But that was the doctrine. When I was stationed in Korea, one of the first times, in fact, no, the first time I was on staff duty, I had to review status reports, and I had recently signed for my platoon. And the status report said something like my platoon was at 90% strength. And the reality was it was probably closer to 40 or 50. And I was actually a little dismayed, so I called up an officer I trusted, a captain, and I said, listen, this looks wrong. And since we're going to securely fax this to 8th Army, why don't we make sure it's the truth? And he told me, Dan, just do it. Just report the false status. Tell them that the entire battalion is stronger than it is. Anecdotally, I can tell you during the 90s that there were officers in the military, in the Army, lying about status. It doesn't mean these lies were going to guarantee defeat. It just means they were lying. And the thing about lying is it becomes kind of a habit for a lot of people. So when people say to me, you know, what do you think would happen if the U.S. faced Russia? I have no idea. I don't trust the U.S. government in any of its status reporting. I don't trust it with respect to weapon systems. The F-35 looks like a giant flying fucking joke to me from my perspective. So I would say you should ask the question and seriously ponder, could the United States fight Russia today one-on-one conventionally and win? And more importantly, could we fight them in the Ukraine? Extended supply chains, extended logistics, really questionable cultural understanding. I mean, in essence, the Ukrainians are repeating the mistakes of the Nazis, and they're doing it with their own fucking people. Okay, they're alienating their own people. The only way you're going to keep the Ukraine from folding like a house of cards at this point is with mercenaries or the United States. So the question is, if you sent a couple hundred thousand American troops into the Ukraine, could we in fact defeat Russia? And in my opinion, the answer is probably no. In fact, it could end up turning out quite badly, not just in the Ukraine, but in Syria, where there are Russian forces and United States forces. It could be really bad. There's evidence, and you can do your own research. There's a professor, I think, from Michigan State University who did a lot of research on this. But there's evidence that between 10 and 20 trillion U.S. dollars are missing from the United States military budget over the last two or three decades. That's a lot of money. And keep in mind, back in 1998 at good old Fort Lewis, we had the Clinton administration telling us there was no money for engine packs. So out of all the M1 Abrams we had, I think a fair proportion, maybe even nearly a third, were not operable. They couldn't make it to the railhead without basically breaking down. The engine pack is the turbine engine that sits in the back of the tank. They're not cheap. Back then, I think one of those packs was about, 1 to 2 million to replace. I bet today it's about 10 times that much. If you can replace it, assuming the parts that go into that engine pack are even manufactured in the United States, you should see where I'm going with this, brothers and sisters. Our nuclear deterrence currently is based upon the belief, okay, that the United States has enough nuclear weapons to defeat anybody else in a nuclear war. But what if that's not true? And again, this is a conjecture on my part, but my conjecture is that the United States has been lying about all readiness to include nuclear readiness, which means worst case scenario with liars, follow the 80-20 rule. Assume that 80% of the forces are not functional. So what happens if we only have a 20%? And that applies across the board, whether it's submarines, whether it's ICBMs, whether it's bombers. What if the real truth is we have about 20% of a functional nuclear deterrent at this point? Well, one of the outcomes of that, especially given that we're no longer in the world of a two-person game theory model, given the listed conflicts or potential nuclear conflicts I just went through, that's not two-person game theory, which means by definition, it's incredibly unstable already. But if in this particular scenario, any of the potential partners or participants, rather, to a conflict suspect that some participant does not have the nuclear capability they claim to have, then all of a sudden, first strike becomes an option. I mean, it actually becomes rational. If you're afraid that the United States government, through economic and unconventional warfare, is trying to topple your government, and you also believe at the same time that it's weak, that it's doing the things it's doing in part because it's weak, it's doing the psyops because it's weak, it's lying like it is because it's weak, then you have an incentive for first strike. It's one thing to consider at this point when you think about the calculus of the Ukraine. Russia currently does not have some really strong formal alliance with China, but there are a lot of informal working agreements between the Chinese military and the Russian military. And so, if you were to say, well, Dan, what would happen in that scenario? It's hard to say. It's hard to say. I think the Chinese and the Russians probably have pretty good intelligence, given their infiltration of our society in the last few decades. I think they probably have pretty good intel on the state of our nuclear arsenal. In fact, you could argue the reason why Putin pulled the trigger is because the Russians no longer fear our nuclear arsenal. It doesn't mean we couldn't launch nukes. The question is, could we launch enough and could we do it soon enough? And if they launched the first strike, could they knock us off the board? 40, 50 years ago, the answer would have been no. But today, I can't truly say that. I'm of the opinion that if the Russians and the Chinese conspired to do a first strike on the United States, there's a real good chance that they could take out our capacity very quickly. And then it's just a question of what do they do next? I do not believe either of those countries would invade. That would be insane. But I do believe they would seek concessions. They would seek agreements, and United States forces deployed everywhere around the world would have to be brought back home. And keep in mind, all of this is going to happen as the US dollar collapses, which means that it could be difficult just getting the troops back home. Okay? Just imagine that. Imagine the dollar being worthless and you have to move hundreds of thousands, if not at this point, almost 1 million people, but definitely hundreds of thousands of people from Japan, from Europe, from Africa, from Latin America, they all got to go home, including the troops in Cuba. Everybody goes home. I don't think that the Russians and the Chinese would be so stupid as to obliterate the planet, but do I think they would take out major strategic targets to include Washington, D.C.? Yeah, yes and duh. They would take out D.C., they would take out NORAD, they would take out every major command and control node. And if the answer is, well, Dan, then all of our submarines will attack, that's assuming the state of readiness is what you think it is. That's assuming that those naval commanders are who you think they are. I don't think this military is the World War II military. I don't even know if it's the military that, attacked Afghanistan after 9/11. I think it's pretty burnt out, and it's filled with a lot of time servers and a lot of people who probably question their oath at this point. Gonna drink a little water here. So when you say things like the nuclear deterrence, you should consider the possibility that the Russians and the Chinese know that we do not have the deterrence we once had. One of the things I'd also mention is that let's say the Chinese and the Russians decided to attack. It's entirely possible that other nations would do their own business. Like, I could see Israel taking care of business. While that was ongoing, I could see them launching a nuclear attack on Iran and vice versa. If the Iranians had any nukes, I could see the North Koreans taking action. The thing about this kind of instability is that participants have a greater likelihood of achieving their ends as the main sort of force of stability, if you want to call it that. The United States looks weaker and weaker. Every conflict makes it weaker. Every engagement makes it weaker. And the likelihood that another country will jump in, pile on for its own agenda increases. This is what I call the firestorm. Okay? This is not two-person game theory. This is not the classic World War III scenario. This is essentially a kind of opportunistic system by which we get into World War III. And then at that point, all bets are off. Because if, for example, Pakistan and India went into open conflict, or Israel and Iran, or a number of other countries, then the calculus of nuclear war gets worse. One of the things about nuclear conflict that everybody should be aware of is that once it starts, the ability to turn it off, to shut it down, decreases. Nuclear weapons are caustic, destructive to the infrastructure you would use to come to a hasty peace agreement to shut down the war. So if China and Russia decided to sneak attack, to do a first strike on the United States, and at this point, given our actions in the Ukraine, that could happen anytime. I also think they would do their best to try to keep other parties from acting, to include Israel. It would be in their best interests to try to come to some sort of hasty diplomatic agreement with many other countries, North Korea, Israel, Iran, you name it. They would probably be willing to give up some big concessions just to make sure that a first strike on the United States did not become full-blown global nuclear war. Now, these are my assumptions and conjectures, and you tell me. I mean, at this point in time, I understand when people say to me, but Dan, isn't nuclear war unthinkable? And I would say, after the last 20 years of aggression on the part of the United States, the answer is nothing's unthinkable. Okay, it's not. It's not unthinkable. It's just something you don't want to think about. And I also would like to point out that if you want to believe the United States has super weapons or super technology, then you must believe in the power of government. I don't. I'm not saying the Russians and the Chinese do. I'm just saying I don't think we do. And I think that our empire is in decline. And when empires are in decline, they often cut corners. And so the question is this empire in decline, and is it cutting corners? If it's cutting corners, it doesn't matter if all governments suck. The Russians and the Chinese just have to suck less, and they can win the nuclear war. They can knock out our government fairly easily. In fact, that conflict, especially if they targeted Washington, D.C., could end within a few days. 1 or 2 days. And probably the United States is a completely different society a week later. And I don't know if that leads to civil war. I would probably say it leads to the quiet civil war, which means the dissolution of the federal government. Yeah, do I think that people will try to form a weak government someplace else? Probably. A new capital where various states will send their reps, maybe. But do I think the states will retain more power than they did before? Yeah. I mean, given the outcome of such a thing, a lot of them will say to themselves, do we really want this to happen again? So I don't know that it ends up in civil war on a conflict level, but I do think it could end up in dissolution, you know? One of the things, too, I want to mention before I continue is that even right now, as I talk about this, I have a hard time framing this in terms of an organic conflict. I don't really believe that's what's going on. I don't believe Putin is an independent actor any more than I think Biden is or Xi in China. I think that there's a lot more coordination occurring, and the question is why. The great thing about this Ukraine conflict, one of the great things about it, depending upon how evil you are, is it's more or less put a stop to the cooperative research happening along the Arctic Circle, studying permafrost collapse and the state of the Arctic. And you say, well, damn, what does that matter? Polar bears. Well, I mean, I don't know, buddy. If you're going to start talking to me about NASA and outer space at some point, then I'm going to explain to you that the Arctic is an air conditioner and it's broken. And if you wanted to lie to the world about it, if you wanted to keep that lie going, one good way to do it is to shut down research along 60% of the Arctic, which is in Russia, in Siberia. So when I look at this thing, I don't necessarily see clean agendas on any level. I don't really see Putin as completely independent fighting for the people of Russia. And I think that the COVID should have shown us that there's a lot of very creepy shit happening between all these governments. You know, a lot of weird agreements, a lot of things that don't make a lot of sense. I mean, they just don't. Another thing, too, about conventional conflict, and I've mentioned this in the past, but during the latter stages of the Cold War, as high technology took a position in the forefront of defense, many people who thought about World War III conventionally called it the come-as-you-are war. And what that meant is that the weapons you have at the beginning are probably going to be the only conventional weapons you have, mainly because the technology's become so high tech. It takes too long to produce an individual weapon. It takes too many resources. And I think that still applies. I mean, I think the F-35 is a good example, but just about every weapon system we have is extremely expensive, built by cronies, and it's not like we can scale up the mass production. Think about the Stinger missile. I mean, I heard a story recently that we basically sent most of our Stingers to the Ukraine, and there's no plan for rapid replacement. The reason why is because it's just not that easy, the way the military industrial complex works, to rapidly replace anything. It's not about the defense of the country. If there's a war, something that will become clear to every American very, very soon after it starts is that you were lied to. You were told with propaganda at the Super Bowl. You were told with commercials during the during the beginning of the before the movie started that the United States is spending all kinds of money to protect you. But what if that's a fucking lie? What if most of this money has gone unaccounted for? And what if most of it has nothing to do with protecting you? It might be related to building bunkers for the elites. It might be related to another agenda. But as far as providing good weapons to soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen, what if that's total crap? A lot of people are going to be angry. And I also add this: we do not have the military industrial complex today that can rapidly produce lots of replacements. It can make really expensive boutique weapons that, you know, mostly sort of work, and that's great. But in terms of the World War II scale of mass replacement, that does not exist. So if there were a conventional war with Russia or China or both, there would be an initial, sort of shock and awe to part of the war in terms of conventional usage and whatnot, but then it would grind down to a pause because the United States and perhaps all parties would have to go back to the drawing board and figure out how are they going to make replacements. And then all of a sudden, you're not building F-35s. You're not building B-2 bombers. You're building things that are closer to the technological features of a World War II fighter than to some boutique super fighter that supposedly can take on 50 planes at the same time. No portion of the current quote-unquote fourth industrial revolution is going to make up for this. None of it will. We are stuck in the situation we're stuck in. It is a come-as-you-are war. If a conventional war breaks out between Russia, China, and the US, all the major powers will go through weapon systems rather quickly, and then they'll ask themselves, what next? There's going to be no easy way to invade another country. So whatever you're going to do is going to be mostly about air power, mostly about conventional missiles and conventional bombs, and drones, of course. So how are you going to make that work? And say, well, what about Boston Robotics? Once again, I say, there's a boutique technology that you might be able to make a few thousand of those things, and maybe you'd be able to scale up. Let's say you can make 100,000 Boston Robotics robots. It's going to be sad. You're going to see those things being taken out by really low tech, and you're going to find out that you wasted $1 trillion on an army that could go nowhere. I believe that the collapse of the US dollar at this point is baked into the cake. It's going to happen, period. I think that there's a good chance that there are parties to conflict that are not treaty obligated that could introduce some major wild cards. India, for example. I think a lot of people don't understand India gets weapons from Russia. And the United States has a kind of weak relationship with Pakistan. But we also have a weird kind of globalist economic relationship with India. I mean, it's pretty fucking messy unraveling that fucking turd. India could be a wild card. Do I think that India can project force? No. But I think India can make weapons. And if the Indian people decide to be neutral, that's one thing. If the Indian people decide to pick a side, it's way more likely at this point that they would choose Russia, China over the United States, especially given that the one thing Putin has shown, and I believe will probably be shown to be complete here in a few weeks, is that the emperor has no clothes. That the argument was, well, didn't NATO have since 2014? Yes, they did. They had 8 fucking years to get the Ukrainian military ready to simply do a strategic defense. And it looked like a bunch of biker gangs beating off. That's what the Ukraine defense looked like. Strategically speaking, it looks like every strange skinhead Nazi gang was given some weapons and some, alcohol and say, go rape some Russian women and then try to defend us. It doesn't look like a disciplined defense. But they had 8 years to get ready. So given that they had 8 years, this basically looks like NATO is done. NATO can't do shit. If you're Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and you're thinking about keeping this blockade going against Kaliningrad, you have to ask yourself, who's going to save you? Finland? Sweden? Who? The United States? How's that going to work out? And exactly how long are US forces going to be tenable in Syria once the conflict starts? My answer is that shit's going to go sideways really fast. And then there's Turkey. And Turkey's another wild card. But you know what? As much as there might be some historical angst between Turkey and Russia, I think the more recent angst between Turkey and the EU is worse. And so if the Turkish government had a choice between going down the primrose path with NATO and the globalists, or picking a local sort of situation, or simply being neutral, neutral is most likely for Turkey, neutrality. But probably just after that is a weak alliance with the Russians, a defense alliance. And then what do you do? You know, what is your answer at that point? I believe that the COVID monkey herpes, the BLM Antifa nonsense, and a list of other sort of military psychological warfare operation insults have weakened civic society in the United States of America. And if you think that a war is going to unify us at this point, I believe you're 100% wrong. I think it's going to blow up in their faces. If the United States government decides to launch an aggressive war on rather weak pretexts, I think they run the risk not just of the American people going into a state of revolt. I think they run the risk of the United States military going into a state of mutiny. And then what do you do? China has its own problems. I think China has been in a state of civil war since 2019 or on the verge of one. So China's not going to help you. Canada is not going to help you. Mexico is not going to help you. The Europeans, in my opinion, and this is where I'm getting to this point that I talked about earlier, I think that if the United States got into a full-blown non-proxy conflict with Russia, NATO would fall apart. Okay, it might not be in that order. Probably the first thing to happen is several governments in Western Europe would simply fall. At that point, you would have many actors, many local actors willing to do something. And you would have entirely new governments in France, Germany, and Great Britain within about 2 to 3 weeks. And NATO's done. Okay, so if you think NATO is going to help you, if you think the blue hats are going to help you, if you live on the East Coast and you need your social security check to come in, and you think some blue hat is going to make sure that happens, you are a fool. Probably the most likely outcome is, like I said, probably won't be nuclear, because nuclear opens up too many question marks. And the most likely outcome of the United States getting involved conventionally will be the complete collapse of the U.S. dollar, A, and B, probably the collapse of the U.S. federal government. And that's assuming that the Chinese and the Russians don't take it as an opportunity to launch a sneak attack with nuclear weapons, which, you know, I could see an argument for and against. I would prefer it not happen because it would kill a lot of people. But I also think that there's a point at which you fuck around, you find out. And keep in mind, the United States is the only government in the history of the fucking planet that's used nuclear weapons on enemy cities. So, you know, payback's a bitch, right? I don't know how much more I'll ever talk about this. I've had a couple podcasts where I brought up the Ukraine, and I pointed out that the whole issue disgusts me. I think it was avoidable. We did not have to do what we did in Ukraine back in 2014. That was a lot of crony, crooked nonsense. And who knows how many crooked angles that had. But if the payoff was the death of a lot of Ukrainians, some Russians, and maybe even some Americans, it seems like a really shitty deal. It may have been a good deal for the Obama administration, and it may have been a good deal for the globalists, but the rest of us got fucked. And as I said, the worst case scenario with nuclear war is if it gets out of control. You know, an ideal situation is for rational actors in a nuclear conflict to take out the irrational. How can I put this? The current chessboard between crazy and not crazy favors China and Russia. China and Russia are far more likely to act rationally, and most people look at the stupid shit our country's been doing for the last 2.5 decades, and they say, what the fuck's wrong with these people? And it does not matter who is in office. Obama, Trump, Biden, Bush, Clinton, they've all done wretchedly criminal shit, whether it's starving the Iraqi people or whether it's launching one illegal war after another on the pretext of what was probably an inside job, 9/11. Yeah, people look at us and they think we're batshit crazy. So the problem with the calculus of mutually assured destruction is it's based upon all partners being rational. And if I was In China, the government of China, I'd probably be just as sociopathic and sick as anybody in Washington, D.C., and the same applies to the Kremlin. But it does look like, as fucked up as they are too, that they're behaving more rationally. It is in their best interest to take a crazy person with nukes off the chessboard. It is not in their interest to have a crazy person with nukes and having the ability to use them. That's the firestorm, okay? The firestorm does not require a 10-year non-aggression pact. It doesn't require an Axis alliance. It doesn't even require an agreement. It behaves according to the oligopic model of markets. In small markets, without collusion, various participants will mimic and respond accordingly, and it will look like collusion, but it's not. These countries will simply behave rationally. And as the United States gets weaker, and as the dollar crashes, and it's gonna crash, countries will behave opportunistically. From the outside looking in, it might look like an alliance, but in reality, it's just game theory. And so for Monday, almost noon o'clock, June the 20th, 2022, Bo Blimp Talk. I hope you have a great Monday. I hope you have a great Tuesday. Remember all your duck and cover bullshit if you want to live another 5 seconds. Beyond that, I don't know what to tell you. If you're one of these motherfuckers rooting for a side in this, fuck you. Okay? There is not a side. The only side I can think of as a Christian is the side of Jesus, and what he would want is peace. And there are no good guys. If you think that we're the good guys and the Russians are the bad guys, you've been reading too many fucking comic books. It's not that fucking simple. But I do believe a lot of countries look at us right now and they think we're the fucking ones that are batshit crazy. And in the calculus of nuclear war, this is critical. If another nation thinks you're crazy, they no longer believe you're behaving rationally. It is in their best interest to destroy you first. That is where we're at today. And if you like this podcast, there'll be a link to donate. You can donate as much as you want to. I don't really care. I don't really want to talk about Russia-Ukraine war bullshit ever again. I think the real problems we're going to face, the ones that are mostly being kept from us, are going to make themselves known soon enough. And yeah, pray. Pray to the Lord in heaven. If this is the time of kingdom come, if this is the time of that Jesus comes back, then pray. Pray that he comes. Pray that this is that time. On the other hand, simply pray. Pray for peace. That's the only good advice I can give you vis-a-vis this bullshit. But I can also tell you this, there's a really good chance, I would say better than 50%, that the entire Ukraine scenario was concocted. That it was, yeah, a conspiracy, but not just a conspiracy of NATO, a conspiracy of all partners to include Russia. That it is another kind of distraction to keep you busy. And then the question you have to ask is why? Whether it's the monkey herpes COVID, whether it's the race war bullshit, whether it's any of the bazillion little petty mind fucks that are ongoing right now, okay? The question you have to ask is, why do they want to keep people so angry, so busy, so fucking immobilized? And how long can that last? Have a great Monday.